What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning in to the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight. And man, I have a very special show for you today. On the phone with me, I have a legendary musician who has created a musical gateway for tons of bass players around the world. He is ranked number 3 on Digital Dream Door's list of 100 greatest rock basses of all time. And from 1966 to 1972, he was the bass player for the funk, rock, and soul band Sly and the Family Stone. Please put your hands together and welcome singer, songwriter, producer, and funk bassist, Mr. Larry Graham. How's it going, Larry?
I'm going to add some bottom so that the dancers just won't hide. How you doing, Spud?
Oh, man, I'm doing wonderful, man, talking to you, man. Thank you so much, man, for coming on my show and chopping it up with me, Larry. I'm truly honored, man.
So I came in number 3, huh?
Man, they should have put you number 1, man.
Well, see, I wasn't going to say that.
we got to redo a recount, man.
Oh, boy. No, hey, I'm grateful to be among any numbered at all. Yeah, that's just a blessing to be able to have the gift of music and to be able to play. So it doesn't even matter what number it is to me. I was just joking.
No, I hear you, man. No, I but you know what, though, Larry? I mean, it's pretty obvious from a fan standpoint and from a musician's point of view when we listen to you play. I mean, I consider you one of the pioneers who started a movement as a bass player, man. I mean, your style of slap style bass. And this is back in the 60s and 70s. You know, that was really unheard of, man, because the traditional style of a bass was more finger style. You know what I mean? But the stuff that you did on Sly and the Family Stone was timeless. And still today, you still hear that foundation of going back to those old style of slap licks that you've done, man. So, oh, I can't say enough about it.
Well, thank you.
You know, man, the first thing I want to talk about, Larry, is the track you did with Sly and the Family Stone. Thank you for letting me be myself. That song is still, to me, one of my go-to songs for improvising with other musicians, you know, if I'm jamming with them and just really getting into the element of funk. And that I still feel that today, a lot of musicians still gravitate to that song for funk elements and really doing that improv thing because there's so much space and possibilities where you could take it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, man, how did that collaboration and that composition start?
Well, of course, Sly is the songwriter, but the beauty, one of the beauties of the band is that he would allow each individual to contribute what they do. So Freddie would have the freedom to play the guitar the way he plays it, which only Freddie could play like that. And the same with Greg Rico and other musicians in the band, but myself too included. And so the reason he asked me to be in the band in the first place is because the way he heard me play with the thumping and plucking, which you probably already know the story, is it came about as a result of my mother saying, we're going to just do piano and bass, and we're not going to have drums anymore. And so to make up for not having a drummer, I was basically playing the drums on the bass. But, wow. He allowed us to do that. So on Thank You, I got a chance to be featured doing thumping and plucking. Dance to the Music was mostly thumping. What was unique about that one was the fuzz tone too being added on the bass, which was new. But for Thank You, it was a combination of the thumping and plucking. So, yeah, some folks wondered what I was doing because videos weren't like as popular as they are now, videos all over the place. But after seeing us on TV shows or in concerts, then they could see what I was doing. Oh, okay, that's how that thumping and plucking is happening. And that was really, between Dance to Music and Thank You, a starting point for influencing other bass players to play like that.
I totally agree, man. Like I said, I'm a huge believer as a musician of having a foundation of building your chops together. And, you know, the way it came out with the thumping and the slap style bass licks, man, is just so funky because it really, I think it magnifies the pocket of the song. You know what I mean? It just, you hear it, and it just, it creates room and possibilities of your melody and your different dynamics that you're hitting as a musician. So, man, what a great idea.
Oh, thank you. And the beauty of it is, too, is that, see, my mother and I don't know if you know the story, but we started working together around, when I was around 15, because I was a guitar player before.
Wow.
Yeah, I played guitar before I played bass. I played other instruments, too. Growing up, I took piano lessons and then drums. I played in the school orchestra as a drummer and then the marching band and all that. But then my father gave me his guitar when I was 11 because he wasn't going to play anymore. And so I taught myself how to play the guitar. And so that became like my first love. So when my mother and I started working together, she was on piano and me on guitar. And then we had a drummer. And just one club we worked in had an organ that had bass pedals on it. And I learned how to play the bass pedals at the same time playing the guitar. And we sounded fuller now because we had bottom. But then the organ broke down. And now we missed it because we were used to having that bottom.
Right.
You know. So then I went down and rented a bass, a St. George bass, until the organ could be repaired, but it turned out it couldn't be repaired, so I got stuck on the bass. And, you know, then my mom decided, well, we're not going to have drums anymore, just her and I, piano and guitar, I mean piano and bass, and that's when I started thumping the strings to make up for not having the bass drum, and plucking them to make up for not having that backbeat. And that's why I said it earlier before about the playing drums on bass.
Sure.
That's kind of like what I was trying to compensate for. So when I joined Sly and the Family, you know, it was a blessing to have such a talented drummer like Greg Arrico, that actually we played around each other. It could have been a train wreck. I could have been a drummer that, because I hadn't played with the drummer in years.
Wow.
You know, and so Greg would be the first drummer in years, and I hadn't played with a drummer after creating that style, so it just turned out to be such a talented person as Greg Arrico. So you mentioned thank you, and if you notice around the bass pattern, he's playing around that with his kick drum. We're not bumping heads with each other. You know, that whole beat is just locked in together in a syncopation that's not clashing.
Right. Right. It's like they almost like bounce off of each other in a way. Tight, though. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly. You take out the bass and listen to his drum beat, and it has a uniqueness of its own just with the drum beat. Or you do the other way around and take out the drums, and with the bass, it has something going on. You put them together, and, you know, then it has, it kind of like a couple of pieces of a puzzle fitting together. And it's like, oh, now I see the picture.
Yeah. Yes. Like I say, man, again, it's one of those songs where me and other musicians that I've worked with, man, they just love it. And it just puts so much creativity, you know, within your improvs, your parts and things. And like I say, that beat has its own detailed style. The bass, the guitar, I mean, just those three instruments alone could write out the whole entire song. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, the guitar lines that Freddie would play, I mean, it was just... Folks, they weren't playing those kind of patterns or playing those kind of chords like on Dance to the Music, those sustained chords he plays. Like, what?
Right.
Where did that come from?
Yes.
You know, so each person was able to contribute their uniqueness. And so I was a genius in not only as a writer, but also in allowing that to take place, as opposed to trying to make everybody do exactly what was already in his head.
Wow, well, you guys made history on that one, definitely.
Thank you.
You know, Larry, funk is my foundation as a keyboardist and as a musician. I think everybody's got some sort of core style that they build upon other styles within it. You know,
yeah.
I talk to a lot of musicians, and I tell them that funk can be played at so many different tempos. You got your fast tempo, your mid-tempo, and slow tempo grooves, and it still sounds funky. You know, because there's so many dynamics within the groove, you know, that I think a lot of musicians really take advantage of. And I'm sure you agree with me there.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know, what were some of the temples and certain beat styles that you really like to throw your chops on as a bass player? Are there particular temples, or are you?
Well, when I started playing bass, what was really unique about working with my mother for those years that we were together, playing nightclubs and lounges and so forth, is that you know, when you're playing in that kind of environment, when a person comes up and requests a song, if you know it, they put money in the little money jar.
Right.
That's on top of the piano. We call it the kitty, right? So we made it a point to try to know just about any song in any genre that anybody would come up and request. And she would handle all the songs that were sung by females, and I would handle your Nat Coles and Billy Eckstein's and you know Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett and you know there was the Ray Charles, and so we try to cover all the bases and not just pop or jazz or blues or country, whatever. So it was a blessing for me to work with her because she, you know, she had me widen out musically, you know, so that and as you said, funk can be applied to any of that. Well, later on, that became very useful to me. So because whatever type of song that Sly wrote, you know, I could fall in and still be, you know, funky, regardless of whatever kind of song it is. Because, you know, when you listen back to some of those albums, he wrote all kinds of songs. He had a deep background, you know, has, I should say, a deep background with music as well. And so that equipped me to be able to take my style now and adapt it to anything he might write.
Wow. You know, speaking of composition and production, Larry, you've also emerged as a solo artist, had your own band, Grand Central Station. I remember, man.
Yeah.
You know, I'm only 35, but, you know, I got a really old soul when it comes to music and, you know, things that I listen to. So, I gravitate to a lot of the 70s and 80s type of music, man. And, you know, One in a Million is probably one of my favorite slow jams of all times. I mean,
thank you.
Oh man, it's just, you know, one of those songs, it just stays in your head, and you know the notes, you know the chord progressions, you know the lyrics. You know, it's like I'm a fan of other musicians. Being a musician myself, you know, I play everybody's stuff where, you know, almost feel like it's my own because I just know it and I had it in my head for years and years. Give me some of your tips on what you like to do for production, you know, when you're writing for yourself or composing music for an artist.
When I'm writing for myself, of course, I'm going to start with the heart. It has to come out of the heart, and I want it to reach the hearts of others. So what I play and what I say is how I come about it, how I create it. Now, that will vary. For example, Hair. I wrote that on the bass, starting with the bass. And then even the drum line and everything else is built around that bass pattern. Whereas, you know, there are songs that I write on the guitar. There are songs that I'll start off on the piano. So it depends on the song, but whatever is because like I mentioned Hair, but that's a dominant instrument line in that song. Whereas, you know, you take One in a Million, it's not really about the bass line
right.
So much, you know, and some of the other songs that I've written, whatever, usually it turns out that whatever I wrote the song on becomes kind of like the lead instrument and everything else kind of like fills in around that, like Tisha kind of music, you know, with those lead line synthesizers.
Sure.
They kind of carry, if there was no vocals, you can still make sense of what those synthesizer lines are about. And that's because that's how the song started off. It was built around, I wrote those on the synth. And so whatever instrument I start with and create the song with, I usually tend to let that be the dominant instrument to take the lead. Not necessarily the loudest or, you know, the busiest, but what it's playing and what it's saying is what people usually remember the keyboard lines and the intro to One in a Million, stuff like that.
Right. No, that's a good foundation formula to have. And I agree with you because I totally remember the synth parts to One in a Million, you know, because yeah. I play it too, but it's just something that gives you that ear candy where it's memorable.
Yeah, yeah. And you kind of like build around that, you know, that becomes like the dominant, you know, instrument. And I mean, you could add other stuff to it for flavoring and a little bit of coloring here, but you know, those keys stand out.
Definitely. Larry, I got to talk to you about analog and DAW recording. I mean, you started out when analog was, you know, the only foundation for recording. You know, now we're into where DAWs is kind of like taken over, or has taken over. Give me your pros and cons of, you know, both platforms and what you're using currently.
A combination, actually. Because even if you start off analog and then, you know, add, you know, in the digital world, you got the fatness and the warmth, you know, that comes with analog.
Yeah.
It's definitely a difference. So even if you are going to go to, let's say, a Pro Tools format, but you started off, you know, maybe even with tape.
Sure.
You know, and then you transfer it to a Pro Tools format or whatever you choose to use in the digital world. That seems to hold on to a lot of the warmth to as compared to maybe it's all digital. At least to my ears, if the rhythm track, the bass, the drums, you know, all the rhythm instruments are cut in an analog environment, to me, I can hear and feel the difference than if I do the same thing and just do it all digital.
Right. Now, I agree with you, man. It's just something about that digital world. It's precise. It's clean. I'm not saying that I like noise, but I love the analog warmth noise. You know what I mean?
If you do a combination, because whatever you send to the digital world, it's going to copy that. So if it's an analog sound, then it's going to, you know, you're going to hear the analog sound, even though it's in a digital domain, you know, as opposed to if it just went straight, you know, into the digital. I mean, I can hear the difference with, especially the rhythm instruments.
Definitely. You know, which brings me to the next question. Are there any particular mic pre's that you use for your signal chain running your bass? Let's say if you're just not going to analog, but you want to get that warm sound, so you're just going to run your bass through a mic pre. Is there any mic pre's out there that you have kind of like in your arsenal all the time? Or
not any particular one that I say I just use all the time, because I've been in situations, you know, where I have a choice.
Okay.
And so I will take advantage of the choice.
Sure.
So let me hear that one, and then let me hear that one.
Right.
And then go with the one that sounds the best in that environment, and then enhance it with other, you know, with other gear.
Sure. You know, I know it can vary between studio and live stage. I mean, I'm pretty sure you got separate rigs for both sessions and things. So, yeah, I know it can vary. You know, with the plugins that are on the market, are any specific plugins that you're using on your bass? Or are you still more of an external hardware guy?
External.
Right.
Yeah. Put the big X on that.
Definitely. You know, man, I got to talk about your collaboration with Prince. You and him are just, you know, the dynamic duo, man. I remember seeing a performance of you two and Lenny Kravitz, I think it was the 1999 or 2000 New Year's Eve party. It was on pay-per-view, man, and I bought the show. And it just came to me, man, how versatile you are as a musician. I mean, you're jamming on Lenny Kravitz's tracks, and you're jamming on Prince's tracks. You're doing your own. How was that collaboration with working with Prince? I mean, I'm pretty sure it came pretty close together because he is a huge fan of yours. You know, I remember him referring to you as the Michael Jordan of bass.
<laughs> You know? Well, that's a compliment. Anything associated with Michael Jordan, huh? Yeah, but, you know, he and I, we just hit it off. I mean, the first time we actually got to jam together, I was in Nashville, Tennessee, with Sinbad, Earth, Wind & Fire, Tina Marie. We were doing the amphitheater, and he was at the big arena there. And I forget the name of the arena, but he found out I was in town, and invited me over to the after jam. After we both finished our shows, we was invited over to this place, to this club, to jam. And we had never played together, and I didn't even know that he was, you know, really into my music, or that was raised on my music. I had no idea. But I accepted the invitation, went over, and for the first time, you know, we got together. He called me up, and it was like, whoa. You know, everywhere I turned, he was like right there. Wow. Like we've been playing together forever. And then later on, when I found out, he was raised up on Sly and the Family Stone, but mostly Grand Central Station played a bigger influence, because he was more of a writer, producer, band leader, you know, then. So I had no idea the influence that my music had. But when I got up there on that stage with him for the first time, I knew something was up. It's like, what? And then musically, you know, we hit off. And after we finished jamming that night, he said, well, when you finish this tour with Sinbad and them, you know, would you like to come and join my tour? And I did. And that was the beginning of our, you know, friendship, you know, and our brotherhood. Wow. And ended up coming to Minneapolis, and that's how it started, and that's how it's been for the last 12 years.
Amazing. You know, I also saw you two on an interview together. It was on BET, and this was probably early 2001, maybe two, and you guys were really promoting the independence of music, having your own rights and starting your own independent movement. And you guys were really one of the first publicly to come out and, you know, display the success you guys had in independent artists, running your own label and doing your own CD management. And now we're in an age where this is it. You know, we're finally at a point where we have control and we have distribution, online distribution, and we could really do our own promotions. I mean, did you see that back then? Or was that a choice that you wanted to make because of record label politics and things?
Well, actually, you know, sometimes when you follow your heart or you follow your first mind, you probably heard your parents or grandparents say, you know, I should have followed my first mind.
Oh, yeah.
And it turns out that was right, you know, and sometimes when you do that, yeah. You know, especially when you got the right things guiding and leading you and directing you, you know, and then as a businessman, well, how Prince is as that speaks for itself.
Right. No, I mean, it was a great movement. I mean, I was listening, and, you know, it just made total sense to me. Even back then, you know, internet was really making its mark, and more people started having access to high-speed internet. So,
yeah.
You know, the MP3 conversion, I mean, it hurt us in one sense, but it helped in another sense.
Well, how quickly we adapt, you know, because, I mean, the digital world just kind of like came out of nowhere, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, wow, this is where we are, and this is what's available. This is what you can do with it now. And quickly, folks like you and others and myself, you know, we adapt, and we say, oh, okay, so we're going to do it like this now, you know,
right.
And take advantage of the things that are available, different ways and different avenues that we have of getting music to the people now. And like you said, at first it came in on as like, you know, it wasn't all positive, but, you know, a lot of folks says, okay, I'm going to take these lemons and I'm going to make lemonade.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know, I got to ask also, Larry, man, finding that zone as a musician, do you prefer to be in a studio environment where you can really focus on the compositions and take your time with the writing? Or do you gravitate to the stage where you can really feel the energy of the audience and, you know, the band members and start doing the improv and just really having a good time?
Well, they're both different. It's a different thing. And when I'm in the studio, my focus is on the creativity part of what I'm doing. I'm really trying to make this what I'm feeling and hearing, what I'm feeling in my heart and hearing in my head. And you're dealing with, you know, your equipment, your engineers. It's all about trying to get this on the medium that's going to be presented so people can enjoy the music. It's all about the creativity. When you get on stage, at least for me, you know, it's all about, you know, entertaining folks and really making folks feel good and feel happy that they came. I mean, they went through a lot to get there.
Yeah.
You know, to get dressed and hop in the car and spend money and all the rest that goes with it, la, 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 la. And now they're here and you're standing there in front of them, you know, can you make these folks happy that they came, went through all that effort to come see you? Now my focus is on them immediately right there in front of me. And but in the studio, it's a wholly, totally different focus. You don't have all these, you know, eyes looking at you, ears, you know, set to take in, and hearts ready to, you know, take in what you're going to do to make them happy. It's a totally different mindset. But both of them are very, very necessary. And if you can do that and you take the stage as serious as you do the studio, then when folks do come to see you, they can be made to be happy, as opposed to you make great records, but when they come see you live, it's like, uh-oh.
Right.
You know, and that has, unfortunately, it has happened, you know, to some folks when they get on stage. It's not really about the entertainment. But then again, you know, back in the day, you know, a lot of times we had places to play. You know, people played a lot of gigs and clubs and a whole lot of woodshedding even before they came out in front of a big public.
Wow.
Sometimes, and so that means that they were well polished. They knew how to entertain, how to deal and interact with people. You had more of a training ground.
Right.
But now, sometimes you may come out with a hit record, and maybe you haven't really been doing that for a long time. You know, woodshedding and playing, you know, the club set and the whole nine. And right, all of a sudden, you're thrown in front of, you know, whole bunch of eyes and ears, and you don't quite know how to handle it. You know, so when you can do both, focus on both, and know how to do both, I think that that's a wonderful combination and, you know, a beautiful gift from God to have.
Oh, I totally agree with you, man. You know, bass players have evolved over their last 25, 30 years, and now we have 5-string basses, we have 6-string basses, you know, 8-string, 10-strings. I mean, it's just getting larger and larger. Is there a preference that you play, or are you still on the 4-string?
I play 4-string most of the time. Well, here's the deal. I just did something for my brother-in-law. He's a producer too, Preston Glass. He did with Whitney Houston, and he did dual tones, Kenny G's first. I guess it was platinum or double platinum or whatever it was, but
wow.
He did Aretha Franklin and a whole bunch of folks. Anyway, I did some stuff for him just last week, and I use 5-string. Some stuff that I've done with Prince in the studio, and even on the GCS 2000 and other stuff, I'll do the 5-string. But if I'm on stage, like I say, now I got to put on my other hat.
Yeah.
When I hit the stage, it's only the 4. That's because, you know, I can put that on automatic pilot.
Sure.
I don't really think about playing then. I'm playing, I'm singing, I'm dancing around, I'm having a good time, I'm entertaining the folks, trying to make them happy, and I'm feeling the love that's coming from them, and I'm happy. There's this whole interchange that's going on, and it's all about that. So I can't think about that other string that they added to it. You know, that I can't, you know, in the studio I can think about that.
Right.
And it's not a problem to play it, but I do have to think about it.
Right.
You know, but
right.
My 4-string, that's like, put it on autopilot and let me just have fun.
Wow. Have you had a chance to play around with any fretless or upright basses? Or
I've had a fretless before. Upright, no, I don't have an upright, and I never really spent a lot of time with an upright. I've touched a few, and I love the sound, you know.
Sure.
But I've never really got a chance to spend a lot of time with one to the point where I would, you know, bust out with it on stage or something. I'm not there.
I hear you, man. So, Larry, what is on the musical agenda for 2010, man?
Well, we just got back from a European tour, and then, just weeks ago, we were in Istanbul, Turkey. We did the Istanbul International Jazz Festival. We played two nights, and then we went over and joined Prince for a festival in Paris, France. That was in July, and then we played Worcester, Belgium with him, and then we did some gigs here, got a chance to play here in Minnesota and back east. And so anyway, immediately coming up, I'm leaving day after tomorrow for Baltimore, doing a gig there, and then the next day we're heading for Japan. Wow. And we'll be doing a series of gigs in Tokyo and Osaka. Nice. So that's the immediate thing that's coming up. In fact, I'm looking at suitcases now.
Good deal. Well, Larry, man, it's been a true honor talking with you. Totally inspirational for me, man. Talking to the Funk Master himself, man. I mean, you took it to another level for me, and I appreciate it, man.
Well, you're more than welcome, and thanks for having me. And, you know, I hope that, you know, something I said made somebody feel good somewhere.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
For able to reach somebody's heart.
Definitely. You're an icon, man. You can't help but to, you know?
Oh, thank you.
Well, I would love to have you back, Larry, talk about your new endeavors, new albums. Anything new you got on the plate, man, please come back. You always got a spot here.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Well, you take it easy.
All right, now.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And a big shout-out to Larry Grant for coming on the show and chopping it up with me. You know, he's a huge funk legend, and I'm a huge fan of his work, you know, dating back from his days with Sly and the Family Stone and merging into his own band, the Grand Central Station, and coming out with hits like Hair and Pow. You know, great demonstration of slap bass works. You know, for all you funketeers, man, all you bass players out there, man, you guys know where you pull it from. It's coming from Larry Graham. And, you know, he's opened up a whole new gateway for playing bass styles, man. And a lot of guys just gravitate his style of bass playing and adapt it to their own style of playing. And again, shout out to Larry Graham. For more information on Larry Graham, you need to check out his website at www.larrygraham.com. And again, that's www.larrygraham.com. And for my past and current interviews, you can hit my website up as well at www.spud2tight.blogspot.com. www.spud2tight.blogspot.com. And I also host a podcast on iTunes, so if you have a computer or an iPhone or an iPod, go to the iTunes store, type in the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, click on my image, and you'll have a list of my past and current reviews as well. And I want to thank everybody for tuning and listening in. Until next time, you guys keep it tight. Peace.